It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Glad you could be here as we explore a Washington Post investigation into the world of bodybuilding and extreme training techniques that are pushing bodybuilders to death. Call in with your questions, your thoughts, anytime, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Desmond Butler is an investigative reporter at The Washington Post. He's one of the journalists leading a multi-part investigation exploring corruption and sexual exploitation over decades in the sport. Desmond, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, let's explore first the backstory of how this investigation emerged. You're very open about your late father's connection to the sport as a photographer and directing the 1977 film Pumping Iron that launched Arnold Schwarzenegger to Hollywood. Can you explain what turned your attention back to the world of bodybuilding?
Yes, I really grew up with bodybuilding. I was five when Pumping Iron came out, and I spent a lot of time with bodybuilders. My father made a second film called Pumping Iron 2, which was about female bodybuilders, and I was on the set quite a bit when I was about 10. Got to know a lot of the bodybuilders and then didn't really think about it for decades. Last October, my father died, and a couple months later at a memorial service, an old friend of his from the bodybuilding world approached me and said that he'd like to talk to me at a more appropriate time about a possible investigation. And that's how I got into this theme.
I wonder what it was like for you, having been so close during childhood to this sport, maybe you want to even call it an industry, and then to be away from it for so long. Did you feel like you had fresh eyes?
Yeah, I think I did. And, I took very different eyes on it than my father. My father was a photographer, an artist. He was trying to show the beauty of the sport and the, I think Pumping Iron in a lot of ways is there's a little bit of a wink in the film. It's a story. And it's about an incredible subculture. That's oftentimes funny. And I came at this as an investigative reporter, really looking at the dark side of the sport. And it's just a very different approach.
I wonder what it was like for you at the start of the investigation when you go to the Arnold Classic, which is Schwarzenegger's, this annual contest and really important competition in the sport. What stood out to you when you saw it and you went there?
Well, if you look at Pumping Iron, which was made during what some people would consider the heyday of the sport, the athletes look a lot different than they do on stage now. Arnold Schwarzenegger talks in the film. He compares himself to a classical sculptor where he's going into the gym trying to create an ideal body and, something that might be comparable to Michelangelo's David. He talks about instead of slapping clay on the body, he's using exercises to add mass at various points to try and get to perfection. The sport now is really about being big and, incredible. Some people might even say grotesque. And so that contrast really stood out because you have to ask, how do people get to those extremes?
How do they? What is the steroid use like? What are the drugs?
Yeah, I mean, the level of steroid use has gone off the charts. And it's not just steroids. It's other kind of chemicals. And, particularly one of the techniques that's being used is to take diuretics, which removes the water from your body very close to the competition so that your body looks more lean. And that's extremely dangerous. And one of the things that we found is that a really alarming number of top bodybuilders and really bodybuilders at all levels are dying at a young age.
are you describing their peak week when bodybuilders are at their leanest and their most dehydrated state, ready for competition?
Absolutely. And particularly right at the competitions where they're, you know, taking the diuretics. And we also found that a lot of that's being directed by coaches who are not doctors. And that makes it very precarious.
We're talking about a series of recently unearthed scandals in the world of bodybuilding. Desmond Butler is an investigative reporter for The Washington Post. You can join in on the world of bodybuilding and what you want to know about it, what you want to ask about the series. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So, you know, when they start training and you have a coach, who are these coaches? How do coaches become coaches? What is their background?
Well, I think there's a diversity of backgrounds. I mean, there are coaches who have worked in the sport for decades that have real expertise. You know, there's no certification for coaches. So it really can be anybody that people find credible. And you also have a lot of athletes coming into the sport without a whole lot of knowledge about it, who are putting their trust in coaches, and there's no certification.
When you were investigating the deaths of more than two dozen bodybuilders worldwide, did you find any common threads, anything that was coming up consistently about these deaths, and so many of them so young?
First of all, it was really my colleague, Jen Abelson, who did most of that investigation. But, you know, certainly a consistent theme that we were looking to is that people were dying or going into a hospital right around the contests, which is the most precarious time.
And right around the contest, as you mentioned, it's the drugs. It's also the diet. Can you explain the extreme diets that these athletes are on, these regimens?
Yeah, they're consuming huge number, you know, huge calories, you know, way, you know, multiple times what a normal person would eat in a day. And it's very heavily concentrated in protein. So, you know, people will be eating pounds and pounds of chicken and steak, and also taking amino acids. And that has been shown to be pretty tough on the body.
All this in order to get what's called a pro card. Can you explain how the competition works, and what these bodybuilders are going after?
Yeah, so a typical path in the bodybuilding world is that you start out in small local amateur contests, and you can then qualify for national amateur contests, the big ones. And the appeal of the national contest is if you place high enough, you can get a so-called pro card that will allow you to compete in pro contests and ultimately the biggest contests in the world.
Is there money? Are these bodybuilders making money from these contests as they move up?
Very few bodybuilders can make a living just from bodybuilding. Most bodybuilders have day jobs. At a certain level, if you're really at the top of the sport, you're getting sponsorships for the top contests like the Arnold Classic and the Olympia. You can, if you place at the very top, win hundreds of thousands of dollars in prize money. But it's a very small minority of athletes who are able to do nothing but bodybuilding.
Washington Post investigative journalist Desmond Butler with us, part of a team exploring the world of bodybuilding, the deadly health risks, documenting exploitation, corruption. Join our conversation with your questions about bodybuilding and the competitions, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about a grim portrait of the bodybuilding sport and a Washington Post investigation. It's based on dozens of interviews with people inside the sport, along with looking at the lawsuits and the emails, text messages, other records. Call in about the diets, the weights, the pills, what you know about the sport or have wondered about bodybuilding competitions. 800-642-1234. We have Desmond Butler, an investigative reporter for the Washington Post, and stays with us. Desmond, you dug into specifically the life and work of the leader of bodybuilding's top federations, Jim Mannion. What did you find out about his business practices and how he is treated in the sport?
Yeah, we spent a lot of time looking into the amateur organization of the sport called the NPC. The NPC was started in the late 70s as a nonprofit, a 501c3.
And doesn't it stand for National or Physique Committee?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yes. The NPC, as I mentioned, was started as a charity. Jim Mannion became its president. And we talked to a lot of the people who were on the board of the organization or involved in the organization in some way over decades. And they described an organization that was run kind of with an iron fist, where dissent was not encouraged, where questions were not encouraged. And what we found is that over time, a lot of the oversight was eliminated, and a lot of the kind of checks and balances there were originally elections for top positions in the organizations. Those were phased out. There were audits that stopped happening. And eventually, somewhat quietly, without, according to board members, a vote, although that's somewhat disputed, it became a private organization owned by Jim Mannion. And that under the organization was registered in Ohio, and under Ohio law, that's not allowed. You can't take a charitable organization and privatize it. But that appears to be what happened some years ago. So it seems like the organization was really meant to have been run for the benefit of the sport and the athletes, and in many ways it was run for the benefit of Jim Mannion.
What about
his family?
And his family. What about drug testing? The International Federation of Bodybuilding and Fitness Pro League avoids routinely testing athletes for steroids or performance-enhancing drugs. Could bodybuilding become subject to further federal regulation or investigation?
Well, I mean, that's hard to say. It's hard to speculate what the federal government or the state governments would do. I'm not aware of a sport that has legislative mandates from the government for testing, but there is pressure, because with athletes dying, their liabilities, and also it certainly raises questions about the authenticity of the sport. So, I think that pressure really has to come from the bottom up, not necessarily top down.
I mean, I keep wanting to compare it to other sports and the rigors of testing going on in other sports. What does the World Anti-Doping Agency have to say about bodybuilding?
Well, actually, Jim Mannion is on a, I think it's called a non-associative list, which means that the WADA, the World Anti-Doping Association, has declared him a person that you can't even associate with in order to be considered legit by WADA. So, you know, it's pretty clear that the IFBB Pro and the NPC are not paying much attention to WADA. You know, there are standards in sports, and maybe there'll be greater pressure, especially when it becomes widely known how many athletes are dying, which is really a tragedy.
What about women in the bodybuilding community? How are they treated? What did you find with women bodybuilders in particular?
Well, what we found was pretty troubling. I mentioned that it's not just Jim Mannion, but his family that are involved in the sport. His son, J.M. Mannion, is kind of official photographer for the sport or for the in-house media of the NPC and IFBB Pro. His grandson, Tyler, is kind of heir apparent and a major judge in the sport. And JM, we found, was using his official position and his connection to power, to his father, to pressure female athletes into very uncomfortable positions. And namely, he set up a sports agency where he was representing female athletes, particularly in the category called bikini, which is the least muscled competitions. And he would pressure or encourage athletes to join his management agency. And then the wide perception was that if you did that, you would do better in the contests, which raises serious questions about the authenticity of the judging. And so we found that he was also, in addition to that, running softcore porn sites and pressuring a lot of the athletes to sit for nude photos that he would then use on these sites. And needless to say, if the perception is that you will only place well in the contests if you play ball with J.M. Mannion, that's a very uncomfortable position for any athlete to be in.
Talking about corruption and abuse, recently detailed by a Washington Post investigation with Desmond Butler, one of the investigative reporters that broke the story. Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Desmond, how is the bodybuilding community reacting to your reporting?
You know, it's pretty hard to say. I mean, on social media, there's certainly been a number of athletes who've discussed this, but that's pretty discouraged in the sport. I mean, we talked about how Jim Mannion runs the sport with an iron fist. It is widely believed that if you speak out, that you will be shunned in the sport. And so there's a big disincentive to talk about it openly. That said, we had a kind of tip line posted on our stories, and we've had just dozens and dozens of people involved in the sport reach out with tips, but also with gratitude, a number of whom have said things like, you know, I've seen these problems for decades and I never thought they would be exposed. And we're really grateful that people are talking about that. But I think in terms of people who are actively involved in the sport, for athletes who are still competing, the assumption is that if you speak out in your own name, you're probably not going to perform very well in contests.
Desmond, thank you for sharing your reporting with us. Thanks for joining us.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Desmond Butler is an investigative reporter for The Washington Post. His multi-part series into the world of bodybuilding is called Built and Broken. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We go to Capitol Hill now with U.S. Representative Gwen Moore of Milwaukee on the line. And we start with what it took to get a House Speaker, GOP leader Kevin McCarthy, securing the job while making concessions to a group of conservatives. Colin, with your reaction to what transpired on the speakership, the debt ceiling flashpoint, national security, and closer to home, what economic issues you want Congress to act on? 800-642-1234. Gwen Moore is a Democratic representative from Wisconsin's 4th District, served on the 14-member House Select Committee on Economic Disparity and Fairness and Growth. Congresswoman Gwen Moore, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Oh, it's great. Happy New Year, Kate.
Happy New Year to you, too. So the House Speaker vote took 15 tense rounds of voting over 4 days. What is your reaction to California Republican Kevin McCarthy gaining the position?
Well, Kate, it's obviously it was an extraordinary experience, and we haven't seen anything like this for, I think, 100 years or more. I do think that it certainly makes him a much weaker speaker when you look at the adoption of the rules, which was really the bargaining chip and bargaining point for so many of the Freedom Caucus, the more radical right wing of the conference. And one of the rules that was adopted was that literally a single person, presumably a member of their party, could call for vacating the chair. The threshold is much lowered from previous Congresses. Literally one person could get up and demand that the chair be vacated, and it would force a vote in the House of Representatives.
And just a moment here to back up, yesterday the House narrowly passed the rules package that governs how the House operates. You voted against the rules package, and you're mentioning one detail of it. You know, what concerns you about how the House will operate?
Well, I can tell you that if you thought the first week of Congress was chaotic, just put your seatbelt on, Kate. I think it's going to be a much slower process. I think another part of the negotiations, not necessarily a part of the rules package, but the negotiations that Kevin McCarthy was forced into, you know, provided that members of the 20% of the caucus, which is this right-wing Freedom Caucus, be placed on key committees. I think they insisted on having, you know, three of their members, for example, be part of the Rules Committee. And of course, the Rules Committee is a committee that directs all legislation and makes amendments for the floor in order. I think that when you saw a fight break out on the floor with Mr. Gates, mm-hmm. And Mike Rogers, that was because Mr. Gates was insisting on having really leapfrogging over other members on the Armed Services Committee to head up a subcommittee on armed forces. Now, I don't know what the result of that is, but these are the machinations that we're going through now, is that these Freedom Caucus members are demanding key legislative positions, sort of quote unquote A committee positions on appropriations and other committees. And so we're going to see a Congress that is bereft, I think, of some of the best talent on the Republican side, and instead have some of these far right groups prevailing. And I'll give you an example of Scott Perry. I'm sorry, Kate.
I was going to just jump in and ask you, with the flashpoint over the debt ceiling, are there potential dangers that Americans should worry about revolving around a government shutdown?
Oh, my God. Thanks for raising that. Because the Republicans want to tie raising the debt ceiling to cutting entitlement programs. And, of course, we know what those entitlement programs are. Medicare, Social Security, Medicaid. And we warned people about this during the campaign. Voila. Republicans have a very, very thin margin, and so we're going to have to defend against these initiatives. I just want to point one thing out, Kate, before we go any further. You know, Republicans didn't win the majority in the House. They gerrymandered themselves into this majority. And so for all of their protests and cries that they somehow have the ear and they're the voice of the American people, they are not. They are. This is a minority within a minority.
Do you do you feel you know exactly what the Freedom Caucus wants? Do all Republicans know what the Freedom Caucus wants?
They want to cut a spending right down to the bone. Our first bill on the floor, as you may know, was to cut $72 billion of the $80 billion we provided for the IRS to have the efficacy that it needs, to have the updated technology and software to give good customer service. But not only that, we don't have the ability, the IRS did not have the ability to examine complicated returns to really discern whether or not the very wealthy is people have legitimate tax avoidance initiatives or whether they're tax evaders, tax cheaters. And that's depriving the Treasury of anywhere between $500 million to $1 trillion a year in revenue that we need for all kind of purposes, whether you agree with defense spending or not, or education, health care, for sure. It's depriving the Treasury of those receipts. And, if you're out there and you make $70,000, $80,000 a year, you're paying your fair share because you're getting a wage. And we're taking those monies right off the top. And your opportunity to, quote unquote, cheat is not there. But if you're Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos, and I'm sure these are fine gentlemen, but the ability for them to hire attorneys and to illegally evade taxes the potential is great given the dearth of staffing at the IRS to catch tax evasion.
I'm going to jump in here and reintroduce talking with U.S. Representative Gwen Moore of Wisconsin's 4th District about the 118th Congress, where it goes from here. Representative Moore serving on House Ways and Means Committee. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Andrew is with us from Whitewater. Andrew, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Hi there. I'd just like to point out that there's been in the past a couple contingencies of House members. You take AOC, Ayanna Pressley, Ilhan Omar. They had demands just as this last Republican contingency did. However, they immediately bent the knee to Nancy Pelosi when her demands were made. But really, the one thing I want to ask the listeners is, do we expect to have any real change in government when we keep electing the exact same people to leadership roles, such as Mitch McConnell, Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, and Kevin McCarthy, for that matter? Are we surprised that Washington doesn't change unless actions by small contingencies force it to change?
Andrew, thank you for the call. Representative Moore, what comes to mind for you here?
Well, what comes to mind for me are a couple of things that I've said already. You know, it's not just that we elect the same people. We have gerrymandering. I mean, here in the state of Wisconsin, and, you know, Wisconsin is kind of a 50-50 state. But you look at the state legislature, and you have only a third of the legislature being Democratic because of these contrived districts that are carved out of the gerrymander. And so that is a problem in and of itself. I just want to point out that the leadership in the House for the 118th Congress, all of the older people stepped back. And we have a new minority leader, Hakeem Jeffries, a new whip, Kathleen Clark. These are younger people. And I can tell you, with regard to the so-called squad, they have contributed in a great deal, but they have not overrun the will of the majority of the Democratic caucus. So, you know, if any of these young people come up with constructive ideas, we welcome them, we incorporate them. But unlike what we expect may happen in the 118th, they will not be, you know, they have not been able to overpower the will of the Democratic Party to pass bills. I mean, the 117th Congress was one of the most productive Congresses we have seen in recent history.
And you were able to advance a political and economic agenda with, you know, rare control of the House and the Senate and the White House. So I'm wondering, what is your tact now as you go into the 118th without that type of control?
Well, I tell you, fortunately for us, we did not get this huge red wave. And, you know, my count is that the Republicans have like a 9-person edge over Democrats. So Kevin McCarthy is going to have to come to us for important things like passing the debt ceiling, perhaps, like passing keeping the lights on in Congress and not having shutdowns. And, you know, when he does that, he'll put his own speakership in peril. And so one of the things that we have to do is that we have to protect the investments that we made in the 117th Congress, like, for example, this IRS funding, which, of course, reduces the deficit when you think about it. We need to protect Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act. We're going to find ourselves, you know, being on the defense. Our new chairman of the Ways and Means Committee is going to be a Mr. Jason Smith, who is looking squarely, at least from my intelligence, looking squarely at cutting entitlements under the jurisdiction of the Ways and Means Committee in order to get to a balanced budget. He was the former ranking member on the Budget Committee. So we're going to be very much on the defense, and thank God we have the presidency and the United States Senate. But in addition to that, we are not going to be satisfied with just simply being on the defense. You know, I have some really key priorities
And I want to dig into those, but I'm just going to pause here for a moment with Democratic U.S. Representative Gwen Moore of Milwaukee on the line as we look at the work of the 118th Congress as it gets underway, what she will prioritize. Call in with your questions, your thoughts, anytime, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with Democratic U.S. Representative Gwen Moore as the 118th Congress gets underway. Call in with your questions, your hopes for the new divided Congress. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We had a follow-up question here from Jeff in Delafield, called in and wants to follow up on the work of the House Ways and Means Committee. And Jeff is asking, why is balancing the budget a bad thing?
Balancing the budget is the work of the entire Congress, and it comes out of the Budget Committee. You know, states are required to balance their budgets. Our federal budget has been balanced before. There's nothing wrong with balancing it, but the capacity of the federal government is to have contingencies and to look at contingencies. For example, we would not be able to support the efforts in Ukraine if we insisted on a budget that we put together and contingencies like that rise up. People love to compare the federal government's budget to a household budget. You don't have a balanced budget in your house either. You buy a house and you owe money on it for years. You buy a car, you owe money on it for years. The insistence on having a balanced budget would deprive us of a tremendous ability to look at the future, look at our budget as an investment. The monies that we spend, for example, on building roads and bridges, those are expenditures, but they add to the long-term economic capacity. You don't have necessarily the ability to do that with just a "quote unquote straight money in and money out fair." There's nothing wrong with a balanced budget, but it is not a realistic program for the long run.
You bring up the ability to invest. Sure. You bring up, the example of household and family economic issues. What are your top priorities for the new legislative session? What do you have your eye on?
Well, I am good. I have not given up on our being able to reintroduce the child tax credit. This had a tremendous impact on families, not just the lowest income families, poor families, but middle class families. The recognition that children are our future workforce. We saw, better classroom performance, better diets, better health for our children through this short-term experiment with the extended child tax credit. We reduced poverty by 40%. I also am very, very, even in the midst of this chaos around entitlement spending, I would like to reintroduce my Social Security bill. It's a bill that recognizes, that restores the student benefit that so many of my colleagues in Congress now, folks in their 60s and 70s, benefited from. This is the ability for, children of disabled or deceased parents to receive Social Security while they attend some post-secondary education, you know, vocational training or college, and to provide a benefit for those American citizens who have the blessing to be able to age into their 80s, recognizing that people's needs change as they become older. I think that original Social Security bill really didn't anticipate people living to be 80, but people do. And that's a point in time, I guess. And, you know, you can't get out there and shovel your own snow. You need extra money. I am also, another priority of mine is the Great Lakes restoration project. Former President Obama introduced it. And it is recognizing the great economic engine that the Great Lakes provide. So it's my priority to make sure that we maintain Lake Michigan, keep it clean, you know, get rid of invasive species, look at ways that we can have more traffic through those channels.
The shipping ports. And something that I don't hear, though, from you, which hits close to home, is the lead issue, the lead poisoning. And, you know, the city of Milwaukee Health Department, lead poisoning in children is an ongoing problem. Is Congress doing enough to help?
Wow, Kate, thanks for lifting that up. You know, I lost many nights of sleep about the lead poisoning in our country. You know, and I used to hear people talk about Flint, Michigan all the time, and it drove me nuts when I think about the 2,500 kids per year that are lead poisoned right in my own district. This is one of the reasons that the bipartisan infrastructure bill was so important, and we need to protect those investments. It would have taken 70 years for us to get rid of all the lead pipes within the state of Wisconsin, with the former level of funding, and now this bill has made that investment, and it's also an investment in workers. Think about the local workforce that we're going to be able to stand up with this investment. And Kate, I just want to bring one other thing up.
And very quickly, we're almost out of time here. Yes,
we have put monies into HUD to get rid of the lead paint, which is actually the greatest source of lead poisoning for our children. And so I'm on top of this. This is really a high priority for me, and it has always been. And I thank you for lifting that up.
Representative Moore, thank you for joining us.
And thank you, Kate, inviting me again.
Gwen Moore is a U.S. Democratic representative from Wisconsin's 4th Congressional District, entered her 10th term, first elected to the House in 2004. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.